I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Ivan Coyote joins me now. The acclaimed storyteller and author of 10 previous books has just published a new one, Tomboy Survival Guide. It's a memoir told in stories, and they are funny and moving, and they and tell us about this remarkable life thus far. Whether you're someone who doesn't fit in the identities or labels that the culture or society at large, the media, or your family foist on you, or you're in for some laugh-out-loud trenchant humor, or you want to be touched by some of the people Ivan has encountered, there's so much in this book. I read it chuckling at some of the marvelous lines Ivan has crafted. I also read it weeping at some of the terrible situations that Ivan faced and faces. I felt affection for the members of the family around Ivan, especially their grandmother. The book is based on a stage show that has toured Canada, the United States, and beyond. I learned a lot about gender nonconformity in this book, as well as about the struggles and challenges that trans people face in our society today. I'm sure you will too, so get it. Ivan Coyote is regarded as one of the country's best storytellers. As a writer, performer, and musician, Ivan has performed for audiences around the world. The many books Ivan has written have garnered good notices and countless awards. The website for more is at ivanecoyote.com. Ivan will be participating in at least four events at this year's Vancouver Writers' Fest. Visit writersfest.bc.ca for tickets and information. The book is published by Arsenal Pulp Press. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Ivan Coyote. Ivan, good morning.
Good morning. Hi, Joe. How are you?
Pretty good. Yourself?
I'm fantastic. So, I'm also in Vancouver, so just a beautiful sort of mid-fall day, and I've got a cup of coffee here.
It's all good. It's the best time of the year, isn't it? Because, I mean, when it's hot, it gets too hot. When it's cold, it gets too cold for some of us. And so this time, where the sun's out, the leaves are coming down, it's just beautiful, isn't it?
I love fall. It's second only to spring, summer, and winter for me.
Yeah. It's a great season for books, obviously.
And
to have a book, this is, I guess, the 11th, is it?
This is the 11th, including books I've co-authored and edited. Yep, it's number 11.
So it's nice for it to come out in the season when we're all talking about books and. You'll be, as I said in the introduction, participating in these events at the Writers Fest. You were born in the Yukon. You grew up in Nanaimo. When did you end up here in Vancouver?
I was born in the Yukon. I grew up in the Yukon. I did have a brief stint in Nanaimo, which my grandmother moved there, so I spent summers there, and then I spent my final year of high school there. But it would be more accurate to say I grew up in the Yukon, although there are several. I can see how you would get that, because there are several. My time in Nanaimo was sort of a big coming-of-age time, and I do write extensively about that time. And I moved to Vancouver, I guess, when I graduated from high school in the Yukon. I went back up for my final last semester, and then I came here to go to music college, actually, little-known fact.
Yeah.
At the time, Capilano College. I was a saxophone major. Yeah.
And then you, because you write in the book about the time you spent at BCIT and you were learning electrics, is that right?
Yeah, when I realized after 2 years of music school and starting to dabble in writing and sort of my early storytelling days, I realized I wanted to be an artist, and so ever the practical blue-collar training from my family in the Yukon, I realized I wanted to be an artist, so I went to trade school, which might seem counterintuitive, but actually it was turned out to be a really smart thing for me. So I went to BCIT, and I took the electricity and industrial electronics course, and came out of there as a second-year electrician's apprentice. Yep.
Yeah.
That would have been in 1992.
Yeah, and because you're obviously, you know, a marvelous artist, but one reads this book and sees just how good you are technically, you have diagrams obviously on how to wire but you get a good sense in the book about how that side of your brain functions just as much as say the artistic side. I mean, that's my observation of these things.
Oh well, that's. That's interesting. I mean, the book is so new, and I only held it in my hands like it's a brand newborn. I think a week ago today. So not a lot of people, the ARCs went out, the advanced review copies went out, but not with all the finalized artwork. So yeah, just so that the listeners know, I spent the better part of the last year and a half whenever I was on tour and all over bookstores, small town bookstores a lot of times when I was on doing school shows and stuff like that, pouring through old manuals.
Yeah.
So there's, I don't know, maybe, 40, 50 sort of, they had to be over 50 years old to have them revert back to public domain, line drawings from old manuals, electrician's manuals, mariner's manuals, crafting manuals, knitting manuals, cross-stitching manuals, weaving, camping, survival, and just playing into that whole sort of riffing off of even the color, that orange, that beautiful orange color that we picked, was designed on
textbooks.
A home appliance repair guide. Yeah. So that was kind of the theme that we were riffing off, like design wise. But yeah, I come from my father's a welder. My uncle is a contractor, a carpenter. My other uncle Fred is a heavy duty mechanic. My uncle Rob was an electrician. My uncle Kevin, who's now passed away, was an electrician and a carpenter, and all around handy person. My uncle Art was a bricklayer. So I guess I grew up in a very trades capable family.
Yeah,
and my cousin Nick is a plumber. My cousin Ryan is a chef, and like that.
Yeah.
So.
And like any good Catholic family, you have a priest too, right?
We did have a priest. He passed away actually on my birthday. In what would that have been? 2012, I guess. It would have been 2012. Yeah, Uncle Father Dave, we used to call him.
Yeah. And I mentioned the Catholicism because I'm a Catholic. Well, I guess a lapsed Catholic, but your grandmother was a regular attendee at Mass, right?
She was a very devout woman. Yeah. I mean, she lived to be. She was very frail her last few years, so she had to quit going to Mass. The last couple of years, but that was always hard on her. But the sisters, there's two nuns. I should have written about them more. They're such fantastic women. They are called the sisters. They're both nuns. I don't believe they're actually technically sisters, but well, they are technically. You know what I mean? But they used to come by on Sundays after Mass and give my grand the update and who was there and who wasn't there and who was wearing what and what the sermon was about and how it all went down.
Yeah.
She was deathly afraid of slipping and breaking her hip like her friend Helen did at bingo going out to Mass. And then ironically, I guess, in the end, she did break her hip, but she broke her hip in her own living room when her foot fell off the footstool and hit the new hardwood floor too hard and cracked her frail old hip. And that ended up being what did it in the end. She was hospitalized shortly thereafter and passed away the following week. In 2009.
The thing that interested me is that when you were growing up as a kid and it was you and your cousins at home, she'd go into Mass and she wouldn't drag you guys or force you to go, right?
No, that's not true. She would sometimes she'd go to Mass. Like, she went to Mass often in the mornings on her own, but we were all scrubbed up. And I guess I should have written. There's one story that should have made it in there, actually, about the time we snuck a garter snake. We didn't have garter snakes in the Yukon, so when she moved us to Nanaimo that one summer of 1981, we were fascinated by all the things that Yukon kids didn't have, like fruit on trees and snakes and more than one radio station. But yeah, we were scrubbed up and hauled off to Mass on more than one occasion. But she was very gentle about her. In some ways, she was. Although my cousins might laugh about this, but she was pretty gentle about her Catholicism. Hers was not a judgy Christianity. Hers was a loving, quiet, really solid. Like, the nuns used to come to her when they had crisis of the faith.
Really?
They would come to my grandmother because she was a true believer.
Wow.
Yeah. If there's ever anyone in the world if there is a heaven, she's right up there.
And
she's got VIP tickets.
It's so beautiful, these stories that you talk about her and just how practical and frugal she was. And I guess a lot of that for you all as her grandkids, some of that's translated to most of you, I guess, right? I mean, I can think of one cousin who is not careful, but most of you all were, right?
Oh yeah, I think that all of us, we talk about it all the time. Like we're like, oh, Gran would be so proud of me right now. What'd you do? It's like, oh well, I just fill in. Oh, I made soup from old chicken bones that I froze and some carrots that were going soft, and it's the best soup I ever made, and I froze it, and I'm gonna, and it all cost me $6. I'm like, oh yeah, she'd be into that. My mom, like, what did my mom say? Oh, mom would have been proud of me. I took something in or got it patched or I fixed it or whatever. So we all, that's one major thing. There's so many things that we all learned from her, and I'm seriously ever so grateful to grow up when I did and where I did and how I did and so entrenched in my family like that. I think it's had a lifetime impact on me, not just how I move in my family, but how I move through the world in general in terms of just my community mind and
And the gift of storytelling that you have, I mean, that obviously comes from the family, does it not?
Absolutely, although that comes from both sides of my family, and, we're talking about the Dawes side so far, but my other side of the family, my paternal side of the family is the Irish side, whereas my gran is Irish and Roma and English. Uh-huh. Well, she was Irish and Roma, born and raised in London, England, and told to lie about both of those things, told to tell everyone she was just a good English girl like everybody else.
Yeah.
As a result of the sort of racism and anti-Irish sentiment in England at that, and in her formative years. My other grandma's Irish, full-blood Irish Canadian, and a lot of the storytelling vibe comes from that side of the family too. I'm not even the best storyteller in my family. I'm just the one that wrote it down.
Yeah, and so does it begin with that, with writing it down for you? I mean, I mentioned in the introduction that this book is based on a stage show that you've toured with. How do you craft the stories that you tell? I mean, does it really begin with the blank piece of paper, the blank computer screen?
No. I don't think any. I get asked that question a lot, and for me, they're so intertwined. Live storytelling and performance, stage, whatever you want to call that phenomenon. A lot of stories before I even put them to page, I've already told them and crafted them for sometimes years. Other stories, like much of the book, and only I would say 10% of the book is included in the stage show.
Yeah.
There's some pieces that I originally wrote for the book that we tried out as part of the live show and scored. The live show is myself and Pebbles Zilikas on bass, Allison Gorman on trumpet, and Sally Zori on drums. It's an all tomboy band. Yeah. We just call the project also Tomboy Survival Guide. And so there's pieces that we tried out and scored that we might pull back in, but we sort of crafted the show. The first incarnation of it would have launched at Push Festival in February of 2015. Mm. So going on 2 years ago, I guess. And so a lot of those pieces started like literally as performance pieces first. And then there's other stuff in the book that I put myself on a pretty strict regime. Where I got a gold star if I got 1,000 words done in a day.
Yeah.
And so all of last summer, I think I got 43,000 words done in 43 different days, getting 43 gold stars. that was just, I don't know how, I guess I was maybe a teacher's pet or something. Actually, I wasn't. I was quite the opposite of a teacher's pet. But that's the sort of game so some of those pieces haven't been read out loud at all in that book. But, I mean, that performance element has been a part of my craft since the very beginning. So it's very hard for me to separate stage and page voices in some ways.
Yeah.
Although you have to some extent with much longer pieces, right?
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Well, what made
this sort of answer your question?
Oh, no, and it explains why it was such a delight to read, because it reads, you use your eyes to read, but the words that you've put in this book are for the ear as well. And
that's been a part of my craft ever since the beginning. And, you know, it's one of the reasons why I like working with Brian Lamb, the editor. He's a great human, and he's got a good vision, and I like Arsenal, and I like the books they put out, and I'm proud to be in that stable with many of those fine writers that Arsenal also backs and supports and publishes. But one of the things is that Brian and I have been working together for a long time now, so he allows me that rein, which is grammar comes fourth or fifth for me.
Yeah.
It's about the musicality of a sentence. It's about the phrasing, the breaths, the space in, the alliteration, the timing, the musical nuance of how a line gets delivered. And I hear that throughout everything. And I can tell other writers, too, who do that. And I tell my students, and I believe that it's true, that reading something out loud is, if you can't figure out how to deliver your own sentence, if you don't, then there's a problem. And, you know, if you get lost in the delivery, then how can you expect the reader to not get lost in the reading? And that just comes from musical training, I think, and from so many years of putting text with music. And it's just what makes sense to my ear, I guess.
Yeah, and as I said earlier, the technical training that you've had has fed into that, I think, because you realize the sort of patterns in what makes good writing, you know, reading some of these pieces in the book here, and you can see how you've worked through that. And it's not just writing per se, but it's knowing what sounds good for the ear as well as the eye. I mentioned to you before we started, just how much I learned from this book, and one of the things that it got me thinking about is it made me realize how I and a lot of people unfortunately get hung up on how a person looks, and you know, we run into someone, you know, at the store or the bus stop or something like that, and we automatically make, you know, a mental list in our head about who this person is without even knowing them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's something we're all guilty of. How do you suggest we get away from that?
Well, I mean, that could be a huge question, really, right? Because it involves all kinds of isms, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, we judge people based on the gender we perceive them to be. We judge them on the class background that we perceive them to come from, and whether it's close or mirrors our own or is different than our own, right?
Yeah.
You know, like you can tell when someone's super rich, and you know, that's one of the guilty isms that I have. Sometimes I am far more likely to attribute negative character qualities onto someone who I perceive to be super, super privileged and uber rich, like, you know what I mean,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to someone who looks like maybe from the same class background as me, or someone who's visibly, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
So we, you know, I mean, obviously racism is going to play into that for many people. You know, I mean, I think we're really starting to blow that out of the water right now, you know, especially in the States and also in Canada too, how much race factors in on how people get treated, all the way through, you know, from street so-called justice right through to the justice system and the court system, how people are, you know, how all that is. So, I mean, that's a huge question, and I guess, I don't know. I mean, I'll like, put that back to you. You said you learned a lot about that, so I'm assuming that you're talking in terms of my book around people's gender, right?
Yeah, because
and around trans people. So, you know, do you think that you... Like, tell me some of the perceptions that you might have had about trans people before reading the book, and then how that might have shifted for you after. I mean, I think that's a
Yeah, well,
that's a more interesting question, if I dare ask the interviewer.
No, absolutely. There's a line in the book where there's a couple essays in the book where you talk about these parents who write you seeking advice because they have children who are transgendered. And so there was one mom who wrote you because she has a transgendered son. And
transgender.
Transgender son.
We're trying to get rid
of
ED on the end.
Okay,
so,
great.
It would be sort of, if you, like, just to get it to, a way to get it more to click in your head, it would be like saying a mailed student or a femaled student.
Ah, okay.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like, she has a transgender son.
Transgender
or
son.
Or her son is transgender.
Yeah.
As opposed to she has a mailed son or a female daughter or a child who is female.
That's very useful, too, for I'm sure people listening to us. So she, there's a line there that you tell her, because you write such a beautiful, loving, thoughtful response to people like her who write you seeking advice, that the idea that trans people's bodies don't match their brains. You don't buy into that. That's too easy of an explanation, if you will.
Well,
I mean that's such a fascinating way to think about it because I mean we hear that all the time, right? I mean when someone transitions, we assume it's because their brains, are matching their bodies.
I have to qualify that statement. It's and that's my own personal take.
Yeah.
Some trans people might have a very, very different take on things. And, you know, and I think what I'm trying to do in that part, in that piece and in the other letter, Shouldn't I Feel Pretty, is like, is do away with this idea, which is a fallacy, that only trans people struggle in their bodies.
Mm.
Like, talk to any woman that lives in Western society, and quite possibly societies all over the world, but most of my knowledge is based here. But talk to any woman and ask her if she's ever felt comfortable in her own body all the time or not struggled with parts of her body. And so that's my first sort of, the first sort of way that argument doesn't line up for me. I think when it comes to queer and trans and gender nonconforming youth, telling a kid who's 12 years old who already has very little volition over things like what they wear, where they live, if they have to go to school, what school they have to go to, and, you know, all of those things that we don't have control over when we're kids, to then add on top of that, you're trapped in the wrong body as the only narrative, as opposed to how are you struggling in your own body? We all struggle in our own bodies. You know, as a trans person, or as a someone who's struggling to understand their gender identity and where that all fits in with your birth, biological sex, and the world, you know, how can we help you? You know, here's information to help you. You know, but this is something that every human adult goes through to some point. I mean, I don't know. I've only met you on the phone and through Twitter. And a little bit via email through my publicist. But, like, you tell me, Joe, like, what's one part of your body that you've never liked or thought was, you know, too big or too small or too hairy or too thin? Or, like, tell me, is that too personal of a question?
No, it's not. I mean,
Here I am asking the interviewer.
No, this is fine. This is a conversation. I'm a little heavier than I should be. And I don't think
listen to the language already there right
I
now.
I should be.
I'm heavier than I should be, right? So you just basically summed my whole question up, or my whole theory up, right?
Yeah.
So here we all struggle with our bodies a little bit. Trans people, that might look a little bit differently, but my main thing that I want to say is that I'm not trapped in the wrong body. I'm trapped in a world that makes very little space for bodies that look like mine, right? I've had top surgery. So I had a radical double mastectomy. That's, you know, but that's not what makes me trans. And if I hadn't, I wouldn't be any less trans. My main argument against that simple boiled down narrative, is that if we just go, oh, you're trans, I know what that means. You're trapped in the wrong body. you have to do this and this and this and this and this, and then nobody will be able to tell that you're trans anymore. And if you just, you know, went on hormones, and if you did this, and you grew a beard, and you dressed like this, and you talked like this, and you did, you know, and transition fully, which some people want to do, and I understand that,
yeah.
And I support that, and that's not what I'm saying. But when we, when the rest of the world goes, oh, you're trans, therefore all you have to do is this, and then you'll be happy, that's a very handy narrative for the rest of the world.
Mm.
Because it doesn't force the world to go, oh, some people don't fit into a gender box, yet we have this very gendered society, and we always have had this very gendered society, yet we've always had trans people that don't fit into it. So the whole, like, you're in the wrong body takes all the pressure off of society to change or adapt or grow or accommodate or make allowances for or understand or comprehend, and tells trans people, if you do these following things so that the rest of the world don't even have to know that you're trans anymore, then everything will be fine. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The so then how do you change society? I mean, I know that as an activist, you've done a lot in terms you were in the news recently about I saw that TED talk that you did that was just so
yep.
powerful that trans people need a safe place to pee.
Yeah, I mean that's just a starting point.
Yeah.
You know?
So.
To me, that's so basic, and
yeah.
You know, and it's a sign of how far we have to go still, that there's still such a pushback
right.
to something, to me, that's just a no-brainer, and that's going to benefit all of society, right? So that's kind of like, that's beyond, it's even stripped down farther than Gender Revolution 101. It's even predates that. It's like, how could we even get together and plan the gender revolution, you know, until we have a place for all of us to, you know, pee in between the you know,
yeah.
at the break in the meeting. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you know, and I guess I'm sort of, like, forced into this role of activist all the time. Well, not forced, but I mean, you know, but really I'm an artist. It's always been, that's how I got into this stuff, and you know, and I mean, yeah, of course I go to public schools and I respond to the needs of my community that I see in those schools. And I've been going in to speak about queer and LGBTQ issues and more as more kids are coming out and again, this pushback, this stupid HB2 bill in North Carolina and all the legislation on the docket in the States, and before we pat ourselves on the back too, the Conservative Party every once in a while tries to kick at the can of keeping trans people out of bathrooms, lest we get too self-congratulatory.
Mm-hmm.
We definitely have that, and from the looks of Twitter, every time the TED website reblogs or reposts my talk, you know, there's no shortage of bigotry still out there.
Yeah.
Right? But I mean, really, I'm a storyteller and a writer. And that's my first thing, and the political activism and the bathroom stuff and all that stuff. I mean, that's a byproduct of just being a human in the world,
and
you know, one who travels
right.
a lot.
Yeah,
like if I wasn't on airplanes, you know, 200 days or traveling on the road 200 days a year, then finding a public washroom wouldn't be as much of an issue for me.
Yeah. When you think about your life and you look back at it, as you do in this book, because you talk about your childhood, you talk about your formative years and recent experiences, and there are moments in your life that have been traumatic, that have been painful. Does writing about it for you, does that help the pain at all, ease it, perhaps?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think, but that goes for everyone. And I think that goes for me as a writer and as just a thinker and a reader. I mean, writing has helped me, like, with my pain. It's helped me with sorrow. It's helped me with joy. It's helped me with love. It's helped me with like. It's helped me with self-reflection and self-improvement. It's helped me with regret. It's helped me with, I mean, I just think, I think that's one of the great, I think that's one of the great redeeming, I think that's what draws so many artists to the creative forces in this. It's not just, you know, to understand your trauma, it's just to understand your place in human existence and what it all means or doesn't mean. And so for sure it's helped me. I don't think that I think writing can be therapeutic, and it can definitely be therapy. I think publishing, there has to be a few more steps in there, yeah. Such as editing and such as distance and context and boundaries and all those other good things too.
So, you know what I mean? Yeah, so there's the mom who I mentioned already writes you because she thinks that you have all your stuff together.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people think that about you, don't they?
I don't know what people think. What's the saying? What people think about you is none of your business.
It can consume a lot of people, though, don't you think?
But beg your pardon?
If you think about it, though, I mean, it does consume a lot of people.
What other people think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm guilty of that, too. Yeah. I'm the worst. I can get some mean tweet from some, like, knuckle-dragging Lugan in North Dakota or something like that. You know, I don't want to blame it all on the U.S. right now, but they're making it fairly easy, aren't they? you know, I can get a nasty tweet about, my favorite are like, you know, you freak. I better not catch you in the bathroom with my daughter, or, you know, I'll show you what my right to carry a concealed weapon looks like. So they're basically, like, threatening to kill me.
Yeah.
If at the same time as they just voted for a bill that makes it illegal for me to actually use any bathroom except the one that their young daughter is in, right?
Yeah, yeah.
They're that stupid. And I, you know, that'll still hurt my feelings for 2.5 days if I got nothing better to think about.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
I don't know
if I look like I have my shit together. I guess one can hope, right?
Yeah, well, I mean...
this is a miracle of social media.
But it must be gratifying that people would turn to you for advice, like these parents in the book have.
And I guess so, when it's not terrifying.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I talk about that. In both of those letters, I talk pretty frankly. I think there's a line in there about, you know, do they even really want to know? I feel just as lost as they do some days, and are two lost people, and you really any better off when they find each other.
Yeah.
And I think to that other mother, I say, like, most days I see the world getting better, and then some days, like, the world piles up behind my eyes, and I had a panic attack in the shower, so I'm pretty honest. I try to be pretty honest and frank with people who come to me for advice that I'm not an expert. I'm really only flying by the seat of my pants and figuring it out as I go along, as are most of us. You know, to be honest, I've always been super, super suspicious of people who set themselves up as the be-all and end-all expert. I think true experts know that we're all just fucking figuring this out as we go along most of the time. Sorry, I don't know if I should...
Oh, no, you can, yes,
it's
absolutely.
It's remarkable that I've got this far into the country and haven't learned yet, really, so, I'm really on my best behavior today.
Well, you're talking to a Catholic, I guess. I think you just... No, but you know, you can curse, and you're welcome to.
You just called it cursing, so I'm not sure if you're being honest about that.
No, I am. There's a wonderful line in the book, and it got me thinking about how to be a better male, in terms of the advice that you give one parent who writes you. So I've got a situation with a friend of mine. I'll seek your advice because you seem like you have your shit together, Ivan.
All right, here we go, Joe. Have you been listening at all? Okay.
So I have this.
Thank you for actually reading my book, too. Can I just say that? Thank you.
Well, no, and I have to say that it's a lovely book because, as I told you, I don't have the time to read all the books
that the authors I talked to.
But it was so enjoyable that I skipped a book that I'm doing an interview on next week because I had to finish your book before I talked to you. I enjoyed it so much.
That's very flattering. Thank you. So let's go.
So this female friend of mine, I just noticed recently the language that she uses. She was criticizing a public figure in the news as weak by saying that he had no balls. And then in another sentence, she was complaining about a particular female politician as weak as well, saying, calling her a pussy.
Yeah.
And so I mentioned this to another friend who said, well, yeah, she always talks like that. And unfortunately, hadn't noticed until very recently that this is the way, you know, this is the lingo that she employed. But it made me realize just these gender stereotypes, how ingrained they are in our culture. Yep. And and it's not just a lack of vocabulary on her part. It's a way that she looks at people through this lens of...
Here's an interesting question, too. Would you have noticed it as much if it was a man doing it?
I would have noticed it, yeah. Because it had to do with the people that she was criticizing. It had to do with, like, I didn't agree with what she thought of these people.
Yep.
So I would have noticed if a male had done that, I think.
So, in
terms of making myself a better male and trying to fix the world in my own little corner, if you will, what should I say to her?
Well, here's the deal, right? It's complicated because you don't want to be a mansplainer either.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So for me, my own little world is fix my own little world first. So take a look at language, like, and I'm constantly doing that, like all the time. And like right now, the thing I'm trying to train myself out of doing is calling everybody guys. Hey guys, especially when I'm addressing like a whole group of people who might be have been assigned female at birth. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Or trans people, or maybe like trans feminine people who might word guys might, you know, because we always go, oh, guys is gender neutral. No, it's not. It's not.
Yeah.
It's no more than fellas or gentlemen is, right? So, you know, I've trained myself away from ladies and gentlemen a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I've trained myself out of, I'm trying to train myself out of seeing guys, fellas. Right now, you know, there was a time where I was really into sort of the butch brotherhood. Now I'm like, I feel like I've embraced my own feminism in a bigger, deeper way in the last few years. And I'm really trying to be more aware of like, I'm a trans person. I was assigned female at birth. I was raised to be a little... a nice, polite Catholic girl. We all know how well that didn't turn out for me. So I move through the world often mistaken for or assumed to be a man. So what is my obligation? And I just start with myself. And I feel like I've got so far to go still with myself that, you know, and if she's a close friend of yours, then you should be in a loving way be able to say, hey, you know, I feel uncomfortable, you know, as a man, I'm trying to work on language and be more conscious of this, and, you know, maybe I feel uncomfortable when you use pussy derogatively, you know, because, you know, it means weak or it means all these things, and, it, you know, have you thought about what that sounds like? But, I mean, I feel like it's more complicated because you're a man and she's a woman, honestly, and I'm not a man, so I have a more, you know, I have a bit more of a sort of circular winding path through these conversations, right?
Yeah.
But I still feel like I'm still working on, okay, I still call older women ma'am sometimes when I'm trying to be polite, and I know that most women don't like being called ma'am at all. They don't like what it, you know. And also really conscious of, like, if you use the word girls, like, who, like, I think the word girls should only be used for groups of girls who are, like...
young women,
sort
yeah.
of 11
mm-hmm.
and under.
Yeah.
Like, by the time you get to, you know, 12, 13, you know, and so I just feel like we just need to look at, like, because language, words have power, and anyone who thinks that words don't have power, sorry, I think is not... looking realistically at it.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, and you're wasting the words that you're using by not thinking about it, I think.
Well, you might be invisibilizing certain people. You might be making some people feel really uncomfortable. And, you know, and I mean, people think, oh, pronouns are no big deal. Well, pronouns are a really big deal for some of us. And for me, when you do the introduction and I realize that you've taken the time to, like, say, to use the they pronoun for me and not make it sound like you're a, bending over backwards to do me a gigantic fucking favor that I should be grateful for. I mean, it's funny that it makes me feel so grateful that you do it in a way that doesn't make me feel like I should be grateful. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right? Some people do that. They get it right, but they point it out, like, you know, like, and they, you know, and it's like, well, you're actually, you're making an effort and that's great, but you're also doing it in a way that makes it feel like it's a big chore for you, right? I'm not saying you because you didn't do it, but you know what I'm saying. Anyway, language is really important. I guess I don't have the perfect answer for you because I'm not a man, and I don't know how close. Like I'd have to have more information to give you true advice on it, right?
But you know,
I've still got so far to go in like unpacking my own masculinity and what that means in the world and how to be. If I'm going to be mistaken for a man or a masculine person, how to do that in a way that doesn't oppress or step on or silence or speak over women around me, you know? And I feel like every masculine person on this planet has to do that work for us to be able to address like real systemic misogyny in our culture.
Well, you know, absolutely. So even just talking about it these last few minutes with you, mm-hmm. I mean, it's made me think about it as I'm listening to you and as we're talking, just how I feel about this and how I'll go about. I mean, I still don't know what I'm going to do about it, but I'm, you know, it's making me think about it, and I guess that's a start. And maybe I wouldn't have thought about this. Well, I certainly wouldn't have thought about this 10 years ago, 15 years ago, growing up in high school. But as I've gotten older, I think, and having read your book, I mean, these are things that now that, I mean, I am checking myself before I open my mouth.
Well, you know what? My work here is done. That's, it, you know, to be able to be in a position where I can have that kind of impact on someone at the same time as just writing a story and having somebody be entertained. That's great. This is one of my first interviews yet about the book that's with someone who's actually really, really in depth read the book. So every writer always is like, are they going to get it? Is it going to translate? Is it going to work? Is anyone going to like it? Am I all washed up? Have I made a mistake? What's the first nasty letter I'm going to get? How have I fucked up? What did I do wrong? What did I forget? Who's going to get mad? I mean, maybe not every writer, but certainly all the writers I knew.
Well, I've talked to a lot of authors. I think you're right.
Right. So but this is pretty much interview number one, and so far so good. Well, thanks, Joe.
Well, one more thing that I want to bring up, because there's an essay in the book about one of your cousins, I guess, was having a child, and they were going to have a gender party.
A gender party, yeah.
Yeah, and so many people are doing this now. I see this on Facebook all the time. There's one TV personality in this town attended one recently and posted photos of it, and they didn't have a cake that they cut that revealed the gender. They live near BC Place Stadium and somehow got them to do the lights as to what the gender of the child would be.
It's actually the sex of the child.
The sex of the child,
party,
pardon me.
But sex party sounds,
yeah, but
sounds a little bit more, like, even more problematic.
Yeah, so I was just so, I mean, the fact that they got BC Place to do that just disgusted me. But, so you write about these things, because, you know, I'm 34, and so a lot of my friends are having kids, and so this is something that's happening a lot in families. What do you make of this whole nonsense of a gender party?
Honestly, to me, it sounds like a weird throwback from the 50s, and you know, that we should be almost sort of laughing at, not bringing back into you know, the society pages.
Yeah.
I expressed this, and so did one of my cousins. You know, and I know my cousins who had the gender party didn't, you know, it's just people have gender parties. It's what they, it's what people are doing these days for some reason.
Yeah.
I don't think that they, I mean, I certainly think, that, and I know for a fact my, there was no malice intended. It was just like a thing that they wanted to do, right? So, yeah, what was the question?
Yeah, I mean, how should we react to this phenomenon that's happening in our cultural lives and in our social lives, if you will?
Well, I'd rather just, like, what's wrong with just a good old-fashioned baby shower,
yeah.
You know? And especially if it's all like, oh, now we know to buy the kid everything pink or everything blue. I mean, come on. Seriously, it's 2016. Like, let's get a grip.
Yeah.
Right? You know, and I mean, that's one of the interesting things about society right now is that there's been research done on children's toys, and they're more gendered now than they were in the 70s.
Yeah.
Like, we had, you know, I mean, you walk into, I think it was Target a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
Took down the boys' toys and girls' toys signs and just put children's toys. And, again, the right wing in the United States, like, had a conniption about it. They're like,
yeah.
Oh, you know, the death of the family is upon us. And it's like, really? Is this whole system, you based your whole fucking society on a gender binary that's so fragile that if a girl plays with a truck, it's all going to crumble down? Like, maybe it should crumble down anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't know. I don't pretend to understand the gender party phenomenon. There's a couple of points in the book where I just crack up because I'm like, you know, why do homophobic evangelical Christian basketball teams all shower naked together in one big room? Like, straight people, but you're so weird sometimes. You know, what can I say? I mean, I say that with great love, but come on, really.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure someone will send you a straight survival guide one day.
Oh, yeah, I need one of those.
This has been such a delight to have you on the show.
Thanks.
And I've kept you longer than I said, so I'll let you go. But, I mean,
okay.
I won't let you go before telling you just how much I enjoyed this book. And I hope it does well for you in terms of sales, because people need to read this.
Well, that's great news. That's great news, Joe. And thanks again for reading it so attentively.
It was such a pleasure to read. I mean, I got to tell you, I enjoyed it a lot. Good luck with this book, Ivan. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. IvanEcoyote.com is the website. The book is called Tomboy.
It's actually Ivan, just Ivan now. I've lost the E. We had a catastrophic website fail. Although we've redirected it. So if you Google Ivan E. Coyote, it will still take you. But the actual address is IvanCoyote.com.
Okay, I'll change that in the introduction.
IvanCoyote.com
is the website. Tomboy Survival Guide is published by Arsenal Pulp Press. Ivan Coyote joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plato.